God's name do you need to solve it for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark
Latham. Good morning, Mark Latham.
G'day, Brent. Always good to be with you. Happy Sunday.
And a happy Sunday to you too. How in the heck are you? How was your week?
Yeah, pretty good. We finished up parliamentary sittings late on Thursday. Got a fair bit done. Government actually passed some legislation, so they'd be pretty happy with that. Yeah, so a busy week.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room. First up, Lydia Thorpe. Yes. I see that Simon Birmingham, he's argued that Lydia Thorpe cannot sit in the Senate while disavowing the Pledge of Allegiance. Look, Lydia Thorpe's come out now with excuses saying why she said this or she didn't say that or she didn't say this. What she did do last week with the possum coat in Parliament in front of King Charles III, most people think it was disgusting, Mark, and are asking why the lady can't be dismissed from the Senate.
Well, she was sworn in, having been elected with the Greens at the last election, then became an independent. So I don't think they're going to kick her out of the Senate. And it's a very awkward thing because clearly she was rude and dreadfully disrespectful to an overseas visitor, the way she carried on there in the Great Hall. But as a senator in that building, there's a thing called parliamentary privilege, which means that nobody can get in the way of an MP who's discharging their genuine parliamentary duties. And while you and I would strongly disagree with how she behaved and what she said, there'd be some people she represents who would say, well, that's her job to articulate these protest views about things that happened 250 years ago in front of King Charles. So I think they handled it probably as best they could. Security in the end escorted her out after she was allowed to have her outburst, but probably Albanese would have known this was coming. It was almost inevitable that she'd make this kind of protest. It might have been better not to invite all MPs to the function, knowing that Lydia Thorpe would pretty well disgrace herself.
She earns the $211,250 was one thing I saw reported yesterday, and she's in the Senate to 2028. Of course, she has said she's not going to stand for election again. I would suggest she probably says that because she realises that she wouldn't win if she did, standing as an independent. As you said, she got into Parliament under the umbrella of the Greens. Fatima Payman got into Parliament, into the Senate, under the umbrella of the Labor Party, and both of those are two examples of politicians that have left the party that they got into, i.e. the Labor Party and the Greens, and have gone out and become an independent. I suppose you're in the same boat, aren't you? Because you were back into the New South Wales Parliament, I suppose, under the umbrella of One Nation, but you are now an independent.
Yeah, well, I think I'm still articulating and fighting for the things I was elected for at the last election. In the federal parliament, the two senators you've mentioned, party names and political parties aren't actually mentioned in the Constitution. So I know that's not the case in practice, but in theory, under the law, individuals are elected in their own right and get to serve out their term. Lydia Thorpe wouldn't be re-elected as an independent because she's up against that Green vote, which would overwhelm her in the Victorian Senate ballot. So she's making her protest known as long as she's there. Mm. There's not much you can do about it other than not invite her to these functions where, you know, internationally, she's going to embarrass Australia, which she did. It was big international news, particularly in the UK. And Albanese in the future, if this sort of thing came up again, he'd be well advised to have a smaller function, maybe just invite the front bench, don't leave back benches out of it. So you've got some MPs there and other dignitaries, former prime ministers and the like. But it was almost inevitable she was going to make this protest and cause Australia some international embarrassment.
Just have a dress code. You're not allowed to wear possum coats.
Well, I always feel sorry for the possums because the Greens and all that say they're in favour of animal welfare, these far lefties, but the poor old possums cop it when it comes to developing a coat. I'm not too sure Lydia Thorpe has ever been out there possum hunting. She must have bought it from somewhere, and, yeah, it just adds to the farce, doesn't it?
Imagine what Dame Edna would say.
Well, it's a dress-up day.
King Charles emphasised climate change as a serious threat calling for action to protect both land and water. The event, led by King Charles III, centred on environmental concerns, with the Ocean Declaration likely being a major outcome. This is at CHOGM, the government meeting, the government heads, the Commonwealth heads of government meeting at CHOGM.
CHOGM in Samoa. And, this was always one of the interesting things about King Charles. When his mother passed away, would he become very political in office? And there's a lot of people who think the climate change cause has been exaggerated, or they don't support throwing people out of jobs or people having to pay higher taxes to try and save the planet. So he's, moved into the political realm, if you like, with these comments in Samoa. And I think the other thing about him is that people would think, don't these things start at home? King Charles and his family own umpteen castles. He'd have a personal carbon footprint bigger than Blacktown. And there's not much evidence he's cutting back on anything. But it's a passion of his, a belief. Anthony Albanese said, well, in most countries, the head of state saying this thing is just accepted as a statement of fact. But it is the first significant time that I'm aware of where King Charles has made a political comment instead of staying out of politics as his mother would have.
Yes, gee, the crowds turned up in large numbers, didn't they, to welcome him and the Queen?
Yeah, the visit to Australia was a success. I don't know about you, Brent, but I was quite surprised by the extent of the crowds and support he received. I know when he came to the New South Wales Parliament this time last week, we were told that if the nature of the visit was ever known, they'd cancel it. They're very worried about security and protesters. Maybe they thought Lydia Thorpe would turn up. But out on Macquarie Street and elsewhere that day in Sydney and later in the week, the crowds were five deep to see the King and Queen, very supportive. And I didn't know Australians sort of still waved the flag for the monarchy. But you'd have to say, for people who went out there, and overall their success was a great trip. And the Australian Republican cause is generations away. It won't be in our lifetime, and maybe never.
So what was for lunch? The most important thing. Tell us what was for lunch.
What was for lunch? You had a choice of a beef dish and beautifully crusted barramundi. That was the main course. There were sort of those petite fours that they have for dessert.
Yeah.
A choice of chocolates and the entree. I can't remember the entree now. It was a week ago, which, as they say, is a long time in politics.
Possibly it was possum.
No possum.
No possum.
No possum furs, thankfully, and no Lydia Thorpe. So our parliamentarian behaved a lot better, and there was no international incident.
Private health insurers a warning of potential premium increases. This is after the New South Wales government raised taxes on the industry to support the public health care system. The new tax will cost insurers up to $3.27 per person each week. That's up from $1.77. Now, as a result of that, premiums could rise by 4.1%, which would add $98 a year for individuals and $156 a year for families. This is according to Private Healthcare Australia. The state government introduced this tax after failing to convince major insurers, those being HCF, NIB, Bupa and Medibank, to fully cover the cost of private rooms in public hospitals.
Yeah, I think this is a big mistake by the Minns government. They had a budget earlier this year where they didn't make any spending cuts whatsoever. So their only option now for trying to reduce the deficit is tax increases to raise revenue. And there are 4 million private health insurance holders in New South Wales. So in the middle of a cost of living crisis, when you've got 4 million people taking out this insurance, to have a slug on them of $156 a week for families is quite significant. And counter to Chris Minns saying that Labor wants to help you with the cost of living, in fact, they're heading the other way, and I opposed this because I didn't think it was very good health policy. And on the budget front, my attitude is, until the Minns government gets serious about expenditure cuts, actually doing something about all the waste and mismanagement in the New South Wales budget, why should we support lazy revenue increases that slug families and make it harder to balance their household budget?
And when was the last time that you read or heard on the news that a health fund was going broke?
Well, they're not going broke, but they have a job to do, and when 4 million people in New South Wales take out the insurance and support them, it's not sort of a question of a marginal or fringe activity. It's a mainstream way of which people contribute through their taxes and then their private health insurance to the well-being of our health system, our hospitals in particular. So it's such a big system. Now, I made the point, you know, back in the day when I was in the Federal Parliament for Labor, we were always trying to get rid of the private health insurance rebate, and I suppose we were against private health insurance. But it's here to stay now. It's part of the equilibrium of health funding and should be treated as such. So, yeah, if the Minns government wants to reduce the deficit, which they need to do, how about some spending cuts instead of slugging families?
A New South Wales politician, that being a former Greens MP and member for New South Wales Legislative Council, Jeremy Buckingham, has claimed the worst serial killer in Australian history may be to blame for dozens of missing or murdered women in the state. He gave an impassioned speech in Parliament about the scores of unsolved cases in the area, which he said had alarming similarity. This was 67 women went missing or were killed between 1977 and 2009 on the New South Wales North Coast, Mark.
Yeah, fascinating story. This, I found it amazing, because Jeremy Buckingham was saying when he moved to Bellingen up north, he had a dream one night about missing people and went to Google it the next day. And over many years of research, he's identified the 67 women who've either been killed or gone missing in the stretch from Newcastle to the Queensland border. Between those years that you mentioned, up to 2009, and he had a meeting with the police minister and some senior police officials during the week where the police said some of these cases are connected, probably not enough police resources have been devoted to looking at the patterns, and was there a serial killer or two or three involved in what is an extraordinary number of people the cases haven't been solved in one geographic stretch of New South Wales. Now, the fact that this all finished in 2009 perhaps indicates that the killer is dead or got locked up for other crimes. Nothing's happened for 15 years. But there will be some police investigations now because of this amazing research by Jeremy Buckingham, who has brought to public attention something that is quite terrifying, really, and is a bigger responsibility for the police to have a better look at it.
New South Wales has banned no-fault evictions. This is under a new law that's going to bring the state in line with other parts of the country, including Victoria. Landlords currently have the power to end a lease without giving their tenant a reason. However, the New South Wales government has passed legislation to ban this practice. Notice periods for evictions will also be extended under the legislation. And the state government said the reforms are going to be rolled out next year, Mark.
Yeah, I think this is poorly timed. I think, you know, whether landlords are liked or disliked in the community, they have rights, and it's now onerous on them to gather proof about ending the rental arrangements. The housing affordability crisis we've got at the moment is not just about ownership, it's also rental and the rising rents that people are paying. If we haven't got people investing in the rental system, then the prices go up further. And this is just another reason why the big apartment developers tell me that, you know, they're investing in Queensland and other states ahead of New South Wales. I don't see how it helps. Maybe you could do it years down the track. But in the middle of a rental and housing affordability crisis, I think it's the wrong time to do this, and just adds to the feeling that investment in rental and other housing in New South Wales is not all that welcome.
We've been talking about animals in rental properties, and Chris Minns has announced the move. So what is the move? Landlords will no longer be able to refuse pets without any reason, but they will still be able to decline in certain specific situations. So Chris Minns has announced the move will be introduced to Parliament next month at a press conference. Your thoughts on that, Mark? It got quite a few emails and phone calls this morning from people. I suppose if we divide it up, it's probably 50-50. 50 think it's a good thing and 50 think it's a bad thing.
Yeah, well, about 5, maybe 10% of all rental accommodation in New South Wales is pet-friendly. The rest of them, pets aren't allowed. And again, it's a decision of the people who own the property, isn't it? I mean, ownership brings with it rights and also responsibilities. I would have thought with the popularity of pet ownership, particularly post-COVID, it would be more commercially appealing for people running these apartment blocks to allow the pets in under sensible arrangements. So I would have thought Chris Minns doesn't need to step in. It's something that the market forces would solve, that if people have got pets and they want to rent, then people with vacant accommodation will find it easier to rent that out if they, you know, accommodate pets under the normal sensible arrangements. So, yeah, I don't think it's something where Chris Minns needs to get involved. The people who own these properties and rent them out can sort it out for themselves.
Well, you'd like to think that, wouldn't you, that landlords are able to make the decision as to whether they want to have tenants in their properties that do have animals or don't have animals. After all, it's the landlord that's gone to the trouble of, you know, borrowing the money, taking the risk, maybe working two jobs to pay for this investment property.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a hell of a lot of extra regulation now and restrictions on what it means to be a landlord in New South Wales. That can't help with the rental affordability crisis. So, Chris Minns, you know, what do you want to run all these places yourself, you know? It's a real nanny state feature where you do have increased pet ownership. Everyone, or a lot of people, got an extra pet as a companion during the COVID lockdowns. They've kept those pets. They love them. And if they're wanting to take them into rental accommodation, the market forces we'll sort that out. It's not the end of the world if someone's got a cat or a dog in a place, as long as they look after them and it's not a nuisance, keeping people awake at night barking and so forth. So if you can avoid all those problems, why wouldn't the landlords allow the pets in? And I think over time we'd see that 5 or 10% figure grow. So again, it's an area where government intervention is just not needed.
The New South Wales government, we're talking about the grants that are being established with the New South Wales government to support people that haven't had power for what, 10 days now as a result of what happened with the transmission lines. This is in the Broken Hill area and TransGrid. I tell you what, there's been a lot of negative comment, a lot of negative feedback on this network about the payments, and it was $200 is going to be made available to each of the residential electricity account holders impacted by the outage, and $400 is going to be made available to impacted small to medium businesses. The grants are available, of course, through Service New South Wales. A lot of people are saying it's not enough money for the people that have been affected. I mean, if you've been without power for, you know, a couple of days, $200 seems to not be much compensation for you.
Well, if your business has been closed down, $400 is not going to make a dent on it, so you might as well not bother with that paltry amount of money. The bigger responsibility is how did it ever happen? Because the transmission lines came down, that was in a storm. Okay, that happens, but Broken Hill is such an isolated location. Surely TransGrid had a responsibility to have the backup generators that in emergency circumstances would keep Broken Hill powered up and keep those small businesses going and keep the households functioning, and they failed in that regard. So government's got to do a lot better in ensuring the TransGrid in the future, this is an area of government intervention, TransGrid now privately owned, has got to have the backup diesel generators to keep Broken Hill up and running if they have future storms that knock down the transmission wires. It's as simple as that.
It is. Just before I let you go, let's talk about the result of the Queensland election. The LMP has claimed victory in the state election. I was surprised to see and hear that they are counting votes today. In previous elections, the AEC has not counted votes on the Sunday. They finish at 10 o'clock on the Saturday and they commence at 9 o'clock on the Monday morning. But they are voting from Queensland time, 9 o'clock this morning. So I suppose it's now 25 minutes that they have been vote counting. By the end of the day, I would suggest that Stephen Miles will finally have to concede that he's lost the election, Mark. So far, he hasn't.
Yeah, well, he should concede because he has lost, and they will get a new LNP government there in Queensland. And the counting of these elections now is totally different to how it was 20 years ago. I watched a bit of it last night, and only 30% of Queenslanders voted on the day, on the election day yesterday, yeah. And the quantity now of postal voting, it's a sort of older population in parts of Queensland, but the postal voting and the early pre-poll voting is by far the most popular way in which people cast their democratic will. So you really don't get a handle on the results. It looked close there for a while. It looks like Labor was competitive or the LNP wouldn't get the 47 seats to govern in their own right. But once the postals and the pre-poll came in, which for various reasons have favoured the opposition parties there, they're clearly going to get over 47 seats. Miles is done for. Sure, the damage for Labor in what could have been a landslide loss there has been limited, but he should concede and congratulate the other side and let them get on with government. Labor's had a good go up there, had a lot of failures, particularly on youth crime, and that's how the coalition have been swept back into power.
Do you think that Stephen Miles is trying to hang on to the position of now opposition leader?
No, it's hard to know. He's just seemed a bit nasty and lacking in grace and, you know, acknowledgement of reality there last night. He's getting a lot of criticism for an election night speech that didn't concede the election, didn't congratulate the other side, and actually continued the campaigning with a critique of why you shouldn't have voted for the coalition parties. Well, you know, the voting's finished, mate. You know, get on with reality now. So he was a bit spiteful in his response. He may stay on in opposition thinking they can come back, Labor, in 3 years into power. But, you know, I suppose the federal implication is it's another election result, just like the ATC, with a significant swing against Labor, a very low primary vote. Although for Albanese, maybe it's easier to campaign in Queensland if you haven't got a Labor state government.
So what are we now, Mark? It's Northern Territory Liberal, it's Tasmania Liberal, and it's Queensland Liberal. Is that right? Or LMP, is that correct?
Yeah, and Labor in WA, South Australia, New South Wales and Victoria. So the Liberals are sort of, you know, the pendulum is swinging back their way, and the federal election next year is sort of perhaps going to head that way as well.
On a knife's edge, Mark.
Well, that's what they say, but I think Peter Dutton now is probably a good chance to come back in, given the failings of the Albanese government. So we haven't got elections for quite some time in those other four states. The next big one is the federal one next year, and, all eyes will be focused on Canberra.
Okay, thank you so much for spending some of your Sunday morning with us. It's always a delight to chat with you, and we look forward to doing it again next Sunday.
A pleasure. Thanks, Brent. Cheers.
See you, mate. Bye-bye. We'll talk to Mark Latham next Sunday. Same bat time, same bat channel, as they say.